The United Nations says no place in Gaza is safe.
As we speak, the only possible way to create safe spaces in Gaza that are truly safe, that protect human life, is for the hell to stop raining down from the sky.
Plus, Ukrainians prepare for a cold winter with attacks on their energy infrastructure.
I think they're waiting a good for them time, and they believe that this good time is a cold weather. And they're waiting a real cold weather to start this attack again.
And later, Russian women have a message for Vladimir Putin, and we'll look at climate change as a public health issue. Today is Tuesday, December 5th. And this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We get an update from Kyiv, and we'll check in on COP28 in Dubai later in the show. We begin, though, in the Middle East, where Israel has intensified its bombardment in and around Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Under U.S. pressure to prevent further mass casualties, Israel said it will be more precise as it widens its offensive into southern Gaza after obliterating much of the north. Satellite photos show tanks and troops massing outside the southern city of Khan Yunis, the latest target of the offensive, which was home to more than 400,000 people before the war. Israel's ordered people out of nearly two dozen neighborhoods instead of the entire region as it did in the north. But there are fewer and fewer places for people to go. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Gazan authorities say at least 43 people have been killed in Khan Yunis on Tuesday alone. Israeli authorities, for their part, say they are trying to limit civilian casualties.
We've been making, again, with everything we have at our in our capabilities, every effort we can to facilitate the movement of civilians in the south in order to mitigate civilian casualties.
That's Richard Hecht. He's a spokesperson for the Israel Defense Force. Even as Israel tries to minimize civilian casualties, there are fewer safe places for them to go. Israel ordered the full-scale evacuation of northern Gaza in the early days of the war and has barred people who left from returning. In the south, it's ordered people out of nearly two dozen neighborhoods in and around Khan Yunis. That further reduced the area where civilians can seek refuge in central and southern Gaza by more than 25%. The UN humanitarian coordinator for the Palestinian territory said nowhere is safe in Gaza and there is nowhere to go. Richard Peepcorn is the World Health Organization representative in Gaza.
The situation is getting worse by the hour. I mean, like, there's intensified bombing going on all around, including here in the southern areas, Khan Yunis, and even in Rafah. Even what I've seen over the last couple of days, that we see an vastly increasing number of IDPs coming from the so-called middle area and even now the southern areas towards furthermore to the south.
The aerial bombardments are not the only challenges facing residents of Gaza, but UNICEF spokesperson James Elder maintains that stopping the bombardments is a necessary first step to improving conditions.
So we have the perfect storm for disease outbreak. Remembering, of course, in this specific case of Gaza, Israel is the occupying power. It's they who have to provide food, water, medicine. So now, given we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people right now, this minute, who are moving somewhere with bombardments at scale, 200 a day yesterday, aerial bombardments, as we speak, the only possible way to create safe spaces in Gaza that are truly safe, that protect human life, is for the hell to stop raining down from the sky.
The United Nations has called for a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians. For his part, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is promising war until Hamas is basically eradicated, and he doesn't appear ready to talk about the two-state solution, something U.S. President Joe Biden has also called for as the solution to years of conflict. My colleague Lori London spoke with Mara Rudman. She's a senior counselor at the Center for American Progress, who previously served as deputy envoy and chief of staff for the Office of the Special Envoy for Middle East Peace at the U.S. Department of State.
I think that we, the United States, needs to be doing several things at once with all of the parties. We need to maximize Israel's ability to defeat Hamas, defeat their ability to control and lead in Gaza, and from that position, continue to work to eradicate Israel, which is Hamas's goal. We need to make sure that as many Palestinian civilians in Gaza as possible are spared from what is going on. We ultimately need to see Prime Minister Netanyahu and the ultra-right wing, frankly, with former terrorists in his coalition. We need to see them ultimately no longer in charge in Israel. We need to have all the hostages returned and Iran deterred, and that the Palestinian Authority, which currently is weak as it is in the West Bank, needs to be reinvigorated in a way that is supported by moderate Arab states in the region and is ultimately able to be in a position to lead a Palestinian state. I don't think that that is the case right now. So those are a lot of different things that the United States needs to do, and we need to do them concurrently. And so, yes, it's important that the UN has called for two states with a capital in Jerusalem. Frankly, there's nothing new in that. Important that President Biden has stated what has been his position for decades and has been the position of every United States president except President Trump since President Clinton, that the ultimate resolution of this conflict, which is very much in the United States' interest, is only going to occur with a Palestinian state side by side with the state of Israel, both secure, stable, and ideally democratic. So that's where we are, and all of those things must be pursued concurrently and not sequentially.
Is it really possible, though, to completely eliminate Hamas? And is the only solution the way Israel has been going about it, by full-on war?
There's a lot implied there. In terms of eliminating Hamas, those are not the words I used. I think what is possible and important is removing Hamas from the ability to control, and frankly, quite unfairly, control the people of Gaza and the governance of Gaza, and use that position to take military terrorist action against the state of Israel. That is different than eliminating. Yeah. And I would put it much more akin to what the United States pursued with respect to ISIS, right? ISIS no longer has a caliphate, no longer controls vast swaths of Iraq and Syria to commit its kind of heinous and barbaric crimes. But ISIS hasn't been eliminated entirely. It still exists in various pockets. The movement exists, horrendous as it is. But to be able to even get to the point that I described in terms of Hamas is a combination of military and diplomatic action. So on the military side, you've seen the United States come out increasingly publicly with what I believe they've been saying privately for some time, which is that it needs to be done much more surgically, and particularly because of the need for Israel at this point to be able to act in southern Gaza as well, which is where the population has largely moved, of 2 million civilians, most of whom are entirely innocent and really trapped in this horrendous situation. So the United States has publicly talked about a much more surgical approach by Israel militarily. It's not talked about Israel not doing anything. It's talked about a surgical approach to the fullest extent possible. Also, be clear that the truce period allowed Hamas to regroup considerably. At the same time, that there needs to be thought to the immediate day after, how will Gaza be governed civilian in terms of civilian structures of governance, where the UN undoubtedly will be heavily involved, as they have been for some time in Gaza, and how will security be controlled? And at the same time with that, how do you build toward ultimately West Bank and Gaza together for the Palestinians in a way that builds towards a Palestinian state? And you ultimately need different actors in place, certainly in Israel, for that to happen. I think it's likely that Israeli democracy will come together to lead to that result post-conflict. And Palestinians, in conjunction with Arab states in the region, need to figure out how to rebuild, revitalize the Palestinian Authority leadership.
And as far as the hostages go, as obviously one of the major elements in all of this, getting them all released, Hamas is claiming it doesn't have a a number of them. What do you make of those claims?
I think it's quite likely to be accurate in terms of the number of different groups, cells, gangs, call it what you will, who went into Israel to commit the horrible barbarism that occurred. That was Hamas coordinated, Hamas led. It was not solely Hamas involved. And it was not even that it was just Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is another, believe it or not, even more extremist group than Hamas that exists in Gaza. I think it could be families, it could be gangs. There's a number of informal groups. And it's very clear that hostages were taken by virtually all of the different cells, elements that went into Israel.
Mara Rudman is a senior counselor at the Center for American Progress and a former chief of staff for the Office of the Special Envoy for Middle East Peace at the U.S. Department of State. She was speaking to my colleague, Lori London, host of Issues in the News here on VOA. Changing gears now, we're headed to Pakistan, where a roadside blast involving a remote-controlled improvised explosive device, or IED, wounded 7 people, including 3 children in Peshawar. Speaking to the media near the site of Tuesday's blast, Kashif Abbasi, a senior officer with the Peshawar police, said the target was most likely a police vehicle that was on routine patrol. The area has seen a marked rise in terror incidents, mostly targeting security personnel, since the Afghan Taliban returned to power in Kabul 2 years ago. So far, no group has claimed responsibility. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll see what things are like on the home front in Russia in a few minutes, and after that, an update from COP28 in Dubai. Now to Kyiv. Ukraine was attacked by Russian drones and missiles. The missiles targeted areas in the east and in the Kherson region, and Chernikova in Kyiv has more.
In terms of the drones, most drones were targeting the west part of the country, particularly there is confirmation from the Lviv region authorities that at least 3 drones hit one of the energy infrastructure facility in the Lviv region. It was confirmed that no casualties were reported after this attack. However, there is certain damage to the facility. At this point, we do not have any confirmation about if this attack caused any energy or electricity difficulties in terms of the region and the country. But again, this is yet another attack that was targeting energy infrastructure.
And targeting energy infrastructure is something we're going to be hearing from you later in the program. You spoke to some people about getting the energy system, getting the energy sector prepared for winter. Can you give us a little preview of what we're going to hear?
So basically Ukraine is entering the second winter under full-scale Russian invasion. And of course, the main topic now in Ukraine is, whether Ukraine will be able to survive this another winter, and also at what scale Russian forces will be ready to attack energy infrastructure. At this point, I can tell that Ukrainians are getting ready to intensified attacks. And it looks like, according to both Ukrainian experts and also international experts, that Russia has certain additional capacities that was prepared in order to attack particularly energy infrastructure. So we'll see how this winter will pass and if Ukraine will be able to survive this winter as it did last winter.
Sounds good. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. We're going to leave it there for now. Anna will be back in just a second with her story on winter preparedness. Anna, thanks again for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
In Ukraine, as we heard from Anna just a moment ago, a second wartime winter has arrived, and the country is working to make sure this one is not as difficult as last year's, when Russian shelling caused severe damage to the power grid and heat delivery systems. Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
In 2022, Ukraine endured heavy damage to its energy infrastructure due to intense Russian shelling. Officials say about 50% of the energy infrastructure was hit, leaving millions of Ukrainians without heat and power for parts of the winter. Oleksandr Harchenko, director of Ukraine's Energy Industry Research Center expects Russian forces to increase their attacks on the power grid and other targets again this year as temperatures plunge.
I think they are waiting a good for them time, and they believe that this good time is cold weather. And they are waiting a real cold weather to start this attack again.
Harchenko says Ukraine has drawn lessons from last winter.
We survived. And we spent this time in between the 7-8 months to restore our system with very deep focus on physical defense, air defense, restoration of service capabilities of the system for the people.
Petro Kotin, the president of Energoatom, Ukraine's largest power producer, says this winter the country is ready to generate and distribute power at full capacity despite Russian rocket attacks.
All 9 units we expect to be on grid, and we increase the protection of these units, physical protection, I mean.
Due to wartime security restrictions, officials are unable to disclose details of those protection measures. Kotin told VOA that while fighting this winter's challenges, Ukraine has also begun to implement a long-term energy security strategy. The country wants complete independence from Russian nuclear fuel used for its Soviet-era V-Ver 440 reactors. In September, fuel supplied by the U.S.-based Westinghouse Electric Company was loaded onto one of the reactors for the first time. The plan is for it to replace Russian fuel completely in the near future. While Ukraine aims to achieve full energy independence from Russia, its main concern now is to survive another winter as the Russian shelling of critical infrastructure intensifies. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
From Kyiv now to Moscow, and a look at the home front there. A growing movement of Russian women is demanding the return of their husbands, sons, and brothers who were mobilized to the front lines after a decree by President Vladimir Putin in September of last year. Maria Andreeva is one of them. Reuters' Fiona Jones has her story.
Maria Andreeva's husband has been fighting in Ukraine for more than a year, but she's waging her own battle in Moscow to get him home. And she's not alone. An increasing number of Russian women are demanding the return of their husbands, sons and brothers from the front line. They were mobilized following a decree by President Vladimir Putin in September last year. Hundreds of thousands of young men rushed to leave Russia. Millions did not, and some of them were called up to fight.
We want our men to be demobilized, to bring them back home to us, because we believe that in a year they have done all they could for the front, and even more that was required of them. They are civilians. First of all, they're losing their skills. They're losing their health, both physical and psychological.
Since Andreeva's husband was mobilized, he's only been back for 2 short breaks to see his wife and young daughter. Andreeva says this is insufficient for a soldier fighting in a conflict.
Just so my daughter understands that you can play with that, that dad is nearby, that dad rocks her in the evening. You see, her dad is very involved and has been so right from the beginning. And it's very hard for her without her dad. And then, boom, here we go again.
As part of their demonstrations, they're aiming right at the top.
We are trying to get through the direct line with the president. Then we will think further. Solitary protests. Something like putting stickers on cars so that they don't forget about us. We will put prints on clothing. Do everything possible to attract attention to the problem. We will also try to interact with the media. Many girls already want to, are ready, are trying.
Tackling the movement is a delicate matter for the Kremlin. Moscow sent tens of thousands of troops to Ukraine in February 2022. In previous wars, it has tolerated higher death tolls than would be politically palatable in Western countries. But the growing movement of Russian women emphasizes the complexity and inequality of keeping so many men at war for so long, especially while many more of fighting age remain at home. Women in Ukraine have also demanded their men be allowed back from the front. Andreeva says Russia's defence ministry has barely engaged with the women. The ministry did not respond to a Reuters request for comment. Andreeva told Reuters the second her husband is snoring next to her in bed, she will end her protests. Reuters did not seek or receive any military or other potentially sensitive information from Andreeva.
That's Fiona Jones of Reuters reporting. Now to Dubai and COP28, where we find former U.S. Vice President Al Gore. He's skeptical of the reported progress claimed by the meeting's organizers. The AP's Ben Thomas has that story.
At the UN climate talks in Dubai, the president of COP28, Sultan Al Jaber, says it's already had some noteworthy successes, among them on day one,
a breakthrough agreement on loss and damage.
That's a fund for countries suffering the worst effects of climate change. Organizers say some $720 million in commitments have already been pledged. But Sultan Al Jaber also heads the United Arab Emirates National Oil Company. Still, he says the phase-out of fossil fuels is inevitable.
And it needs to be orderly, fair, just, and responsible.
In an AP interview, however, former Vice President Al Gore says the Emirati's selection to head COP28 undermines confidence that nations are genuinely working to address climate change.
Instead of bending to the will of the fossil fuel companies, you know, they're much better at capturing politicians than they are at capturing emissions.
Gore calls Sultan Al Jaber a smart guy, but one who has a direct conflict of interest as the head of the UAE's national oil company.
The oil and gas industry made a mistake in overreaching and naming the CEO of one of the largest and one of the dirtiest, by many measures, oil companies in the world as the president of the COP.
I'm Ben Thomas.
And finally today, delegates meeting at the COP28 summit in Dubai have addressed the impact of climate change on public health amid warnings that global warming could increase the risk of deadly diseases. VOA's Henry Ridgewell has that story.
Pakistan suffered the worst flood in its history last year, which scientists say was likely exacerbated by climate change. Thousands were killed and homes and livelihoods destroyed. The floodwaters also provided a vast breeding ground for mosquitoes, leading to a 400% increase in cases of malaria countrywide, the worst outbreak since 1973. Scientists say this is just one example of how climate change is having a big impact on human health. For the first time, the UN Climate Change Conference is addressing that impact at its annual meeting this year in Dubai. Diseases like river blindness and sleeping sickness are spread through parasitic worms and flies, organisms that could proliferate in a warming world. Air pollution from fossil fuel burning kills an estimated 7 million people globally every year. Dr. Isult Gibert is a Canadian physician specializing in the impact of climate change on human health.
Climate crisis is a health crisis. It affects you with air pollution, of course. That's what people might think of right away. So your lungs, but also your cardiovascular system, so that's your vessels, your heart. But it will also affect with the rise of infectious disease, more antimicrobial resistance, and of course all the refugees, climate refugees that are going to be in insalubrious condition, food security.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told COP28 delegates that women's health is disproportionately affected by climate change.
They're in fields, they're in factories, they're in markets, they're doing all kinds of work that becomes absolutely impossible if temperatures get to 40, 50 degrees centigrade.
COP28 host, the United Arab Emirates, along with several charities, pledged $777 million Sunday to help fight neglected tropical diseases that could be worsened by climate change. More than 120 countries at COP28 signed a declaration acknowledging responsibility to safeguard human health in a warming world. But critics say it made no mention of cutting fossil fuels, the main source of greenhouse gas emissions that are driving climate change. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.